only through annihilation of distance in every respect, as the conveyance of intelligence, transport of passengers and supplies and transmission of energy will conditions be brought about someday, ensuring permanency of friendly relations. What we now want most is closer contact and better understanding between individuals and communities all over the earth and the elimination of that fanatic devotion to exalted ideals of national egoism and pride, which is always prone to plunge the world into primeval barbarism and strife. No league or parliamentary act of any kind will ever prevent such a calamity. These are only new devices for putting the weak at the mercy of the strong. I have expressed myself in this regard 14 years ago, when a combination of a few leading governments, a sort of holy alliance, was advocated by the late Andrew Carnegie, who may be fairly considered as the father of this idea, having given to it more publicity and impetus than anybody else prior to the efforts of the president. While it cannot be denied that such aspects might be of material advantage to some less fortunate peoples, it cannot attain the chief objective sought. Peace can only come as a natural consequence of universal enlightenment and merging of races, and we are still far from this blissful realization, because few indeed will admit the reality that God made man in his image, in which case all earthmen are alike. There is in fact but one race, of many colors. Christ is but one person, yet he is of all people, so why do some people think themselves better than some other people? As I view the world of today, in the light of the gigantic struggle we have witnessed, I am filled with conviction that the interests of humanity would be best served if the United States remains true to its traditions, true to God whom it pretends to believe, and kept out of entangling alliances. Situated as it is, geographically remote from the theaters of impending conflicts, without incentive to territorial aggrandizement, with inexhaustible resources and immense population thoroughly imbued with the spirit of liberty and right, this country is placed in a unique and privileged position. It is thus able to exert, independently, its colossal strength and moral force to the benefit of all, more judiciously and effectively, than as a member of a league. I have dwelt on the circumstances of my early life and told of an affliction, which compelled me to unremitting exercise of imagination and self-observation. This mental activity, at first involuntary under the pressure of illness and suffering, gradually became second nature and led me finally to recognize that I was but an automaton devoid of free will in thought and action and merely responsive to the forces of the environment. Our bodies are of such complexity of structure, the motions we perform are so numerous and involved, and the external impressions on our sense organs to such a degree delicate and elusive, that it is hard for the average person to grasp this fact. Yet, nothing is more convincing to the trained investigator than the mechanistic theory of life, which had been, in a measure, understood and propounded by Descartes 300 years ago. In his time, many important functions of our organisms were unknown, and especially with respect to the nature of light and the construction and operation of the eye, philosophers were in the dark. In recent years, the progress of scientific research in these fields has been such as to leave no room for a doubt in regard to this view, on which many works have been published. One of its ablest and most eloquent exponents is, perhaps, Felix Lerdanque, formerly assistant of Pasteur. Professor Jacques Loeb has performed remarkable experiments in heliotropism, clearly establishing the controlling power of light in lower forms of organisms, and his latest book, Forced Movements, is revelatory. But while men of science accept this theory simply as any other that is recognized, to me it is a truth which I hourly demonstrate by every act and thought of mine. The consciousness of the external impression prompting me to any kind of exertion, physical or mental, is ever present in my mind. Only on very rare occasions, when I was in a state of exceptional concentration, have I found difficulty in locating the original impulse. The by far greater number of human beings are never aware of what is passing around and within them, and millions fall victims of disease and die prematurely just on this account. The commonest, everyday occurrences appear to them mysterious and inexplicable. One may feel a sudden wave of sadness and rack his brain for an explanation, when he might have noticed that it was caused by a cloud cutting off the rays of the sun. He may see the image of a friend dear to him under conditions which he construes as very peculiar, when only shortly before he has passed him in the street or seen his photograph somewhere. When he loses a collar, button, he fusses and swears for an hour, being unable to visualize his previous actions and locate the object directly. Deficient observation is merely a form of ignorance and responsible for the many morbid notions and foolish ideas prevailing. There is not more than one out of every 10 persons who does not believe in telepathy and other psychic manifestations, spiritualism and communion with the dead, and who would refuse to listen to willing or unwilling deceivers. Just to illustrate how deeply rooted this tendency has become even among the clear-headed American population, I may mention a comical incident. Shortly before the war, when the exhibition of my turbines in this city elicited widespread comment in the technical papers, I anticipated that there would be a scramble among manufacturers to get hold of the invention, and I had particular designs on that man from Detroit who has an uncanny faculty for accumulating millions. So confident was I that he would turn up someday, that I declared this as certain to my secretary and assistants. Sure enough, one fine morning a body of engineers from the Ford Motor Company presented themselves with the request of discussing with me an important project. "Didn't I tell you?" I remarked triumphantly to my employees, and one of them said, "You are amazing, Mr. Tesla. Everything comes out exactly as you predict." As soon as these hard-headed men were seated, I, of course, immediately began to extol the wonderful features of my turbine, when the spokesman interrupted me and said, "We know all about this, but we are on a special errand. We have formed a psychological society for the investigation of psychic phenomena, and we want you to join us in this undertaking." I suppose these engineers never knew how near they came to being fired out of my office. Ever since I was told by some of the greatest men of the time, leaders in science whose names are immortal, that I am possessed of an unusual mind, I bent all my thinking faculties on the solution of great problems regardless of sacrifice. For many years, I endeavored to solve the enigma of death, and watched eagerly for every kind of spiritual indication. But only once in the course of my existence have I had an experience which momentarily impressed me as supernatural. It was at the time of my mother's death. I had become completely exhausted by pain and long vigilance, and one night was carried to a building about 2 blocks from our home. As I lay helpless there, I thought that if my mother died while I was away from her bedside, she would surely give me a sign. 2 or 3 months before, I was in London in company with my late friend, Sir William Crookes, when spiritualism was discussed, and I was under the full sway of these thoughts. I might not have paid attention to other men, but was susceptible to his arguments, as it was his epochal work on radiant matter, which I had read as a student, that made me embrace the electrical career. I reflected that the conditions for a look into the beyond were most favorable, for my mother was a woman of genius and particularly excelling in the powers of intuition. During the whole night, every fiber in my brain was strained in expectancy, but nothing happened until early in the morning, when I fell in a sleep, or perhaps a swoon, and saw a cloud carrying angelic figures of marvelous beauty, one of whom gazed upon me lovingly and gradually assumed the features of my mother. The appearance slowly floated across the room and vanished, and I was awakened by an indescribably sweet song of many voices. In that instant certitude, which no words can express, came upon me that my mother had just died. And that was true. I was unable to understand the tremendous weight of the painful knowledge I received in advance, and wrote a letter to Sir William Crookes while still under the domination of these impressions and in poor bodily health. When I recovered, I sought for a long time the external cause of this strange manifestation, and, to my great relief, I succeeded after many months of fruitless effort. I had seen the painting of a celebrated artist, representing allegorically one of the seasons in the form of a cloud with a group of angels, which seemed to actually float in the air, and this had struck me forcefully. It was exactly the same that appeared in my dream, with the exception of my mother's likeness. The music came from the choir in the church nearby at the early mass of Easter morning, explaining everything satisfactorily in conformity with scientific facts. This occurred long ago, and I have never had the faintest reason since to change my views on psychical and spiritual phenomena, for which there is no foundation. The belief in these is the natural outgrowth of intellectual development. Religious dogmas are no longer accepted in their orthodox meaning, but every individual clings to faith in a supreme power of some kind. We all must have an ideal to govern our conduct and ensure contentment, but it is immaterial whether it be one of creed, art, science, or anything else, so long as it fulfills the function of a dematerializing force. It is essential to the peaceful existence of humanity as a whole that one common conception should prevail. While I have failed to obtain any evidence in support of the contentions of psychologists and spiritualists, I have proved to my complete satisfaction the automatism of life, not only through continuous observations of individual actions, but even more conclusively through certain generalizations. These amount to a discovery, which I consider of the greatest moment to human society, and on which I shall briefly dwell. I got the first inkling of this astonishing truth when I was still a very young man, but for many years I interpreted what I noted simply as coincidences. Namely, whenever either myself or a person to whom I was attached, or a cause to which I was devoted, was hurt by others in a particular way, which might be best popularly characterized as the most unfair imaginable, I experienced a singular and undefinable pain which, for the want of a better term, I have qualified as cosmic, and shortly thereafter, and invariably, those who had inflicted it came to grief. After many such cases, I confided this to a number of friends, who had the opportunity to convince themselves of the theory of which I have gradually formulated and which may be stated in the following few words: our bodies are of similar construction and exposed to the same external forces. This results in likeness of response and concordance of the general activities on which all our social and other rules and laws are based. We are automata entirely controlled by the forces of the medium, being tossed about like corks on the surface of the water, but mistaking the resultant of the impulses from the outside for the free will. The movements and other actions we perform are always life preservative, and though seemingly quite independent from one another, we are connected by invisible links. So long as the organism is in perfect order, it responds accurately to the agents that prompt it, but the moment that there is sane derangement in any individual, his self-preservative power is impaired. Everybody understands, of course, that if one becomes deaf, has his eyes weakened, or his limbs injured, the chances for his continued existence are lessened. But this is also true, and perhaps more so, of certain defects in the brain which deprives the automaton, more or less, of that vital quality and cause it to rush into destruction. A very sensitive and observant being, with his highly developed mechanism all intact, and acting with precision in obedience to the changing conditions of the environment, is endowed with a transcending mechanical sense, enabling him to evade perils too subtle to be directly perceived. When he comes in contact with others whose controlling organs are radically faulty, that sense asserts itself and he feels the cosmic pain. The truth of this has been borne out in hundreds of instances, and I am inviting other students of nature to devote attention to this subject, believing that through combined and systematic effort, results of incalculable value to the world will be attained. The idea of constructing an automaton to bear out my theory presented itself to me early, but I did not begin active work until 1895, when I started my wireless investigations. During the succeeding 2 or 3 years, a number of automatic mechanisms, to be actuated from a distance, were constructed by me and exhibited to visitors in my laboratory. In 1896, however, I designed a complete machine capable of a multitude of operations, but the consummation of my labors was delayed until late in 1897. This machine was illustrated and described in my article in the Century magazine of June, 1900, and other periodicals of that time, and when first shown in the beginning of 1898, It created a sensation such as no other invention of mine has ever produced. In November, 1898, a basic patent on the novel art was granted to me, but only after the examiner, in chief, had caught in New York and witnessed the performance, for what I claim seemed unbelievable. I remember that when later I called on an official in Washington, with a view of offering the invention to the government, he burst out in laughter upon my telling him what I had accomplished. Nobody thought then that there was the faintest prospect of perfecting such a device. It is unfortunate that in this patent, following the advice of my attorneys, I indicated the control as being effected through the medium of a single circuit and a well-known form of detector, for the reason that I had not yet secured protection on my methods and apparatus for individualization. As a matter of fact, my boats were controlled through the joint action of several circuits and interference of every kind was excluded. Most generally, I employed receiving circuits in the form of loops, including condensers, because the discharges of my high-tension transmitter ionized the air in their laboratory, so that even a very small aerial would draw electricity from the surrounding atmosphere for hours. Just to give an idea, I found, for instance, that a bulb 12 inches in diameter, highly exhausted, and with one single terminal to which a short wire was attached, would deliver well onto 1,000 successive flashes before all charge of the air in the laboratory was neutralized. The loop form of receiver was not sensitive to such a disturbance, and it is curious to note that it is becoming popular at this late date. In reality, it collects much less energy than the aerials or a long grounded wire, but it so happens that it does away with a number of defects inherent to the present wireless devices. In demonstrating my invention before audiences, the visitors were requested to ask questions, however involved, and the automaton would answer them by signs. This was considered magic at the time, but was extremely simple, for it was myself who gave the replies by means of the device. At the same period, another larger tetatomatic boat was constructed, a photograph of which was shown in the October 1919 number of the Electrical Experimenter. It was controlled by loops, having several turns placed in the hull, which was made entirely watertight and capable of submergence. The apparatus was similar to that used in the first, with the exception of certain special features I introduced, as, for example, incandescent lamps which afforded a visible evidence of the proper functioning of the machine. These automata, controlled within the range of vision of the operator, were, however, the first and rather crude steps in the evolution of the art of telautomatics as I had conceived it. The next logical improvement was its application to automatic mechanisms beyond the limits of vision and at great distances from the center of control, and I have ever since advocated their employment as instruments of warfare in preference to guns. The importance of this now seems to be recognized, if I am to judge from casual announcements through the press, of achievements which are said to be extraordinary but contain no merit of novelty whatever. In an imperfect manner, it is practicable, with the existing wireless plants, to launch an aeroplane, have it follow a certain approximate course, and perform sane operation at a distance of many hundreds of miles. A machine of this kind can also be mechanically controlled in several ways, and I have no doubt that it may prove of some usefulness in war. But there are, to my best knowledge, no instrumentalities in existence today with which such an object could be accomplished in a precise manner. I have devoted years of study to this matter and have evolved means, making such and greater wonders easily realizable. As stated on a previous occasion, when I was a student at college, I conceived a flying machine quite unlike the present ones. The underlying principle was sound, but could not be carried into practice for want of a prime of sufficiently great activity. In recent years, I have successfully solved this problem and am now planning aerial machines devoid of sustaining planes, ailerons, propeller, and other external attachments, which will be capable of immense speeds and are very likely to furnish powerful arguments for peace in the near future. Such a machine, sustained and propelled entirely by reaction, is shown on one of the pages of my lectures, and is supposed to be controlled either mechanically or by wireless energy. By installing proper plants, it will be practicable to project a missile of this kind into the air and drop it almost on the very spot designated, which may be thousands of miles away. But, we are not going to stop at this. Telautomats will be ultimately produced, capable of acting as if possessed of their own intelligence, and their advent will create a revolution. As early as 1898, I proposed to representatives of a large manufacturing concern the construction and public exhibition of an automobile carriage, which, left to itself, would perform a great variety of operations involving something akin to judgment. But my proposal was deemed chimerical at that time and nothing came of it. At present, many of the ablest minds are trying to devise expedients for preventing a repetition of the awful conflict, which is only theoretically ended, and the duration and main issues of which I have correctly predicted in an article printed in the Sun of December 20, 1914. The proposed league is not a remedy but, on the contrary, in the opinion of a number of competent men, may bring about results just the opposite. It is particularly regrettable that a punitive policy was adopted in framing the terms of peace, because a few years hence, it will be possible for nations to fight without armies, ships or guns, by weapons far more terrible, to the destructive action and range of which there is virtually no limit. Any city, at a distance, whatsoever, from the enemy, can be destroyed by him and no power on earth can stop him from doing so. If we want to avert an impending calamity and a state of things, which may transform this globe into an inferno, we should push the development of flying machines and wireless transmission of energy without an instant's delay and with all the power and resources of the nation. End part 1. Part 2, The Venusian Spaceship the X-12. By Arthur Henry Matthews, R's Introduction, How did the world's greatest inventor invent? How did he carry out an invention? What sort of mentality did this wonder man have? Was his early life as commonplace as most boys? What was the early training of this man from space? Was he an Earthman? Did he come from the planet Venus? Was he born on the spaceship? The answers to these and many other questions will be found in this story from the lips of the man himself. In this autobiography concerning his early youth, and so on, we obtain a good insight into the wonderful life this man led. It reads like a fairy tale, but strange as it may be, it is true. Tesla was no common mortal. He led a charmed life, given up by doctors at least 3 times as dead. He was a young man at 60 and at 70, with a brain just as keen the day he died, if he did die, for, many believe he did not. He always said he would live to the age of 150, so perhaps he is alive on Venus. That might be easy to believe now, for if man can build a rocket to the moon or Venus, there is no reason to doubt that science on that planet could be 1,000 years ahead of Earthman's. We know that spaceships have landed on Earth, all through the ages. Tesla said that he believed he came from the planet Venus, and during the landings of a spaceship on my property, the members of that ship said that Tesla was a child from Venus. Tesla will tell you in his own words, what he believed. Read the story with care, there is a lot between the lines, as you will see. He had one great vice, his generosity. He could have been the richest man on earth. He made and spent millions. He was an idealist of the highest order, and to such men, money itself means but little. Foreword by Arthur Matthews. Chapter 1. In relating this account of the landings of a large spaceship on my property at Lackport, of my strange experience in meeting with people who claim they were from Venus and what I learned about life on their planet, I would like to emphasize that I consider myself of little importance in this story. If my name is known at all, it is due to my long friendship with Nikola Tesla and an intimate knowledge of his great work for mankind. Perhaps I may be excused if I say that it affords me a certain amount of amused satisfaction to realize that I am now probably the last living person who knew and loved Tesla, but in all humility, I am aware that it was only because Tesla left me some of his ideas to develop that I was thus able to meet these people from Venus who claimed Tesla as one of their own. Due to the fact that my story covers several visits of the Venusian spaceship, I am, for space reasons, condensing its details into one account and will therefore leave out dates. It is sufficient to say that the first visit was in spring, 1941, with continued landings about every 2 years until 1961, which, to date, included the last landing. These landings took place on my 100-acre property in the hollow of a large meadow formed by the sloping mountainside at the back and the rise of ground at the front. It was on a spring morning of 1941 that I was standing near my workshop with my son, Humphrey. We were discussing some matter relating to electrical waves when suddenly Humphrey looked up and exclaimed, "There's something wrong with the sun." I looked to the east and gasped in astonishment. Exactly in the center of the golden disk there was a round black spot about one quarter the apparent diameter of the sun. It was too big to be a sunspot and besides, it was moving. As we watched, it crept slowly to the upper edge of the sun and in about 10 minutes had left the solar disk when it simply vanished from sight. We saw nothing more of it that day. I went to bed early that night but could not sleep. An oppressive sense of something strange impending descended on me like a pall. Finally, I arose and dressed. I went outside and looked up at the sky, but all I could see were the stars sparkling in full brilliancy. I returned to the house and settled down to read, but not for long, for suddenly the alarm signal on the telescope rang shrilly. I ran outside and at first saw nothing except the sparkling stars. Then I noticed something queer toward the mountain. It appeared to be darker than usual. It was indeed, for some huge object seemed to cover most of the mountain. I began to walk toward it and as I came near to our barn, I was suddenly confronted by two persons. Both men were nearly 6 feet tall and in the brilliant starlight I could discern their bright blue eyes and golden hair, but what registered with me most was that these beings radiated an aura of perfect health and happiness. Immediately I sensed a feeling of goodwill emanating from them which took away any fear I might have had at this sudden meeting. They were wearing grey coveralls and somehow I knew then that they were space beings. I noted with interest that both were bare-headed, with no helmets or other apparatus, and yet they seemed to have no difficulty in breathing Earth air. I have since been asked if there were any physical differences from Earthmen about these space people and I can only say that I saw none, and why should there be? Are we not all built the same, in the likeness of God? Then one of them spoke to me in very good English, saying, "Good morning, Arthur Matthews. May we go with you into your workshop?" If this was a surprise, there was a greater one to follow, as he continued, "We are from Venus and we have come to see what you are doing with Tesla's inventions." Completely taken back, I could only blurt out, "How am I supposed to believe you are from Venus?" The one who appeared to be the leader answered calmly, "When you see our ship, you will believe. But, before we go, I will make a sketch of Tesla's anti-war machine. No one on Earth but you knows its secret. Will that convince you?" I nodded and led them to my workshop. With a few deft strokes, he drew a sketch for me which I could only accept as the truth. A brief inspection and explanation of the work I was doing on the Tesla devices followed. No comments were made and I was left to assume they were satisfied with my efforts. Then the two Venusians said they would take me to their spaceship. We walked toward the mountain and soon I was staring wide-eyed at the gigantic proportions of the mother, ship X-12, hardly believing my senses, while my two companions chuckled at my bewilderment. The landed ship, which appeared to be made of grey metal, looked like two gargantuan saucers put together rim to rim. Circling these rims about 20 feet away from the main body of the craft was an unsupported band of material, later referred to as the guide ring, which was not attached to the ship by any visible means and appeared to be held in place by some magnetic force. Penetrating the center of the ship was a tubular shaft 50 feet in diameter and 300 feet in height, the top and bottom ends of which protruded from the ringed saucers which were 700 feet in diameter. The bottom end of this large tube rested on the ground, and I could see an open doorway in which stood two of the crew who greeted us with a hand salute. My companions invited me in for an inspection tour of the great ship, and we stepped into an elevator which I was told had no cables and was operated by willpower. We stopped off at the level which was devoted to the storage of some of the 24 small spacecraft this mother ship carried, ground vehicles and other equipment. The second level comprised the living quarters of the crew, gardens, recreation area, study rooms and a meeting hall.